Welcome, everybody. We are jumping into it pretty briefly again. You may have noticed we've been doing some shorter intros and outros lately. That is thanks to patreon.com/ShaneMoss, which has given me an outlet for sharing more of my personal life, my views on things, from interesting to silly, absurd, dark, and everything else on what I've been calling the Everything podcast. You can go there if you miss hearing me wandering aimlessly through the inner workings of my mind, and you can be caught up on everything that I'm doing. But the important stuff that you need to know for now is that I have a couple shows coming up in Minneapolis and Grand Rapids in May. More stuff. I just am in the middle of confirming a few summer gigs, including my 20-year high school reunion going back to La Crosse, Wisconsin. So I'll be doing a show before the reunion on the 27th. That might be a bad idea. It might be really weird. I have no idea. But more dates filling in soon. I always love it when you guys can come out and support my live stand-up. So go to ShaneMoss.com. And with that...
Are we?
Yes.
Where are we?
Here.
Why are we here? Not entirely clear. We are misfits thrust into existence by random chance, with no hints at all as to how we're supposed to make sense of it all. It's immensely bizarre. Here we are.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Here We Are podcast. Today, I'm talking with Assistant Professor in the Department of Biology at the University of Oklahoma. Catherine Marski is joining me. Catherine, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So you are interested in biodiversity and beetles, especially. We actually just had a whole dung beetle episode.
Oh, fantastic.
Episode. So I think my audience is nice and primed.
Excellent. That's good.
A little
to hear.
Beetle talk. I was looking over a few of your things, and I have a couple questions. The listeners and myself, we're going to get to learn a couple new terms today. Can you explain to me what is phylogeography? Did I say that right?
Phylogeography.
Phylogeography. So close.
Very close. So to explain phylogeography, we need to zoom out a second and talk about biogeography, which is basically the geography of life. So what species are distributed where and why? And so if you think about how the world is oriented, in your travels around the U.S., you've probably noticed that in different places you see different things. Like in Portland, there are lovely lush forests with a certain component of plants and animals. And down here in Oklahoma, where it's a lot drier and a lot windier, you see totally different things. And so that's biogeography. Phylogeography is a special subset of that. It's looking at the distribution of genetic diversity in space. And so within a species, particularly one of my beetles, for example, where in that species' geographical distribution is there the most genetic diversity and where is there the least and why? And so it looks at how species' histories are related to their landscapes. Is there a large barrier that the species has trouble crossing, so you get genetically distinct populations on each side? Have they moved a lot in the past? So if you think about what this place would have looked like 21,000 years ago during the last ice ages, species had very different geographical distributions. So the species which are here now, which like this kind of warm temperate climate, would have been crunched into a few places that we call refugia. It's basically a climatic refuge. It's a place where the conditions were still good for them. And then all of the northern plains would have been, the parts that weren't glaciated would have been a lot colder and windier. And so there was a totally different component of species, things like the woolly mammoth. And so this movement in species past, you can actually read it in their genes. But this is important and interesting is that it tells us how communities of species came to be in a particular place. We can look at, did most of the members of this community travel through time, through history together, or have they come individually some sooner, some later. And this lets us look at the evolutionary and ecological processes that allowed these communities to form. And also looking at as populations diverge and stop sharing genes with each other, this is one of the beginning steps in the process that leads towards speciation. And so we can look at the drivers that cause species to arise, basically, the biodiversity to be increased by additional species.
I actually found out a new interesting thing looking over a little bit of your stuff. There was a woolly rhinoceros.
Is that, yes.
How come you never hear about the woolly rhinoceros? That's amazing.
The woolly rhinoceros lived mostly in Eurasia, in Siberia, and a little bit over into Europe as well.
The mammoth gets all the publicity.
The mammoth made it across the Bering Strait, and so here in North America we find mammoth and mastodon remains. We find remains of the large sloths, which would have come up from South America. Not so many woolly rhinoceros. There's something about, possibly something about the environment of the land bridge of the Bering Strait that maybe made it difficult for them to cross. We're not entirely sure, but we have our own exciting extinct species over here in North America.
People talk a lot about climate change these mm-hmm. days. It's a big deal, but the climate has always been changing.
Right.
Slightly different factors nowadays, but the climate's changed. You mentioned the Ice Age. It's changed dramatically over the last 50,000 years. When usually when we talk about extinction of like mammoths and that sort, I usually assume that it's humans having driven a lot of things to extinction. But I imagine there was a lot of climate had a lot to do with the population changes through time.
Right. So this has actually been a fairly hot topic over the last, I think, probably even more than 20 or so years, but particularly within the last few years. And it makes sense that it would be really interesting, because this is extinction of very large, charismatic, recognizable species, which has happened in our time as humans, right? And so it makes sense that we have questions about our role in that and other biological factors that would have been taking place. So my colleagues and I were interested in the role of climate in shaping the distributions of these species, and we found that just modeling climate and the population genetic patterns, which show what the population size would have been, there is a correlation between several large megafauna species that were common in the past and climate change.
So you're talking about the big species getting all of the attention?
Right. So globally, there has been a disappearance of megafauna species that, with many land masses, corresponds with the arrival of humans to those land masses. So in North America, we lost the mammoths, the mastodons, several of the large sloths. In other places like Australia, there used to be quite large birds, which they've lost most of. New Zealand lost the moa relatively shortly after humans arrived. And then there are places, particularly Eurasia, where it's always been a little less clear whether it was humans or climate which drove some of these large species to extinction. And so my colleagues and I were interested in looking at the role of climate, and we compared that. We modeled species distributions through time and compared that with population genetic signatures from ancient DNA, which is when you get DNA actually from from subfossil bones. So like if you imagine you find a mammoth bone, or even in some cases a whole mammoth carcass, you can actually get some DNA from that in some circumstances. And I should say that this was done with my colleagues at the University of Copenhagen. And so we looked for a correlation between population genetic diversity, which indicates overall population size, and range size. And we found that for some of the species, there is a tight correlation with climate, which suggests that climate had an important role in shaping those species' trajectories. This was particularly the case for the muskox and the woolly rhino, which, as you said, it's really a pity that we didn't have those here because they must have been awesome. With other species, it looks like there was a much more balanced role between climate and humans. And then for the charismatic woolly mammoth, we were unable in this study to conclusively say whether it was one or the other. Subsequent evidence has come out. A lot of people have worked on this, and it looks like even though people, particularly in the Siberian region, would have been at relatively low population numbers, just because the woolly mammoth reproduced so slowly, it probably wouldn't have taken that much pressure to actually have an impact on their populations by hunting. And then a study came out within the last couple years that showed that the last populations of woolly mammoths on Wrangell Island, this tiny little island north of Siberia that they would have gotten to when it was still connected by land, they went into some sort of genetic meltdown, it looks like. So serious inbreeding problems. They were just not doing very well. And it's probably because this island was just too small to be host to very large herbivores. And at that point, they were extinct in lots of other places. And so it's what I think the ultimate answer is, and what evidence now suggests, is that it wasn't one or the other, but a combination of both. But it probably happened faster with humans. So I don't think we can take either of those factors out of the picture. And so where this is then interesting for us is like, oh, so we have caused extinction in the past, potentially. So how does this compare to what's happening today? And we're in a very interesting time, basically. Biodiversity seems to be in a major crisis right now. Extinction is one of those things that happens naturally throughout the fossil record. Most species are alive for a period of time and then disappear. But in the past, there have been these periods of mass extinction. So one example that most of us are familiar with is the dinosaurs.
Right.
And it's considered a mass extinction not because the dinosaurs all disappeared, but because a whole bunch of other species disappeared with them. And it was a disaster in the sense that it wasn't something that a species could be kind of evolutionarily prepared for, right? And evolutionary selection, natural selection happens relatively slowly and gradually through time. And so that's why you have species which arise and then go extinct very slowly and kind of at a regular pace. But a sixth extinction is where something, or a mass extinction is where something like that, something happens that just kind of upsets that whole pattern. You have a disaster, several things disappear, the total biodiversity on the face of the Earth at a given time is vastly reduced, down to up to 75% of species can disappear. There have been times when up to 90% of species have disappeared. And so what happens next is kind of a new... Biodiversity looks very different. So the disappearance of the dinosaurs gave way for the mammals to become much more dominant creatures than they had previously been. And then, of course, we have the birds, which are also sort of dinosaurs, became much more prevalent. And so we see very different components to the biodiversity that eventually replaces what's lost in these, you could even say, cataclysms.
It's supposed to be an exciting time to do your job with kind of DNA sequencing becoming what it is today with the advancements and making it cheaper and everything else. Is it? I imagine you're kind of able to make new discoveries sort of left and right nowadays. I mean, like 20 years ago, was it a lot much harder to do the sort of things that you're trying to do?
So one of the things that's changing is the amount of time that you spend at the lab bench. Mm-hmm. So it used to be that the process of getting your sequence was very difficult and would take quite a lot of work. And now the actual work that you do in the lab takes a couple days and that's it. It's replaced by work at the computer. And the way that we get DNA data these days has changed, and so you need kind of a large computational component to stitch those data back together because of the way that they're... So it used to be that we would isolate a few large fragments of DNA, and this is Sanger sequencing, and it's been around for, I think, about 30 years, maybe a little bit longer. And this is still something a lot of us do when we're kind of testing new species, just to see what is the baseline level of genetic diversity. And this is being replaced by genomic methods, which allow us to sample a huge amount of the species genome and relatively the same amount of lab work. So we just get so much more information out of each of these samples. Of course, when you get all that information, you need to figure out what to do with it. And so that's where a lot of the new avenues are now, is figuring out how to process this information and search this information. And that's really fascinating. And for the work that I do, figuring out how to scale this up at the population level is one of the kind of hot avenues right now. And so it is absolutely fascinating to be able to see how this works and see which is going to be the technique that we settle on as the best for population genetics. But yeah, it's a very different ballpark than when I did my undergraduate and PhD studies.
How do you know when you're looking at a sample of DNA, or you find some old fossil in your analysis? How do you know how representative that DNA is of what the average population would have been at that particular moment in time in that place? How do you? It seems pretty complicated with the flow of genes coming in and out. And
yeah, that's a really good question. So for the work that I do, we try to get good geographical coverage, so representatives of this particular beetle species from across its geographical range. And then we try to get a lot of samples within each of those populations so that we can have an idea of how representative each individual is of that regional population. And the inferences that we make are based upon the relative commonness or scarceness of particular genetic sequences. There are also methods for when you have the full genome of just one or two individuals to make those inferences based on different regions within that genome. And I'm not as familiar with those methods because I'm not using those, but a lot of people who are working with human genetics are at the forefront of pushing some of those methods. Because you can imagine if you find human or hominin fossil remains in various places, those are very difficult to get. It's just a matter of luck whether you're going to find really exciting archaeological remains that will allow you to extract the DNA. So for someone like me, where I can just go out and collect very easily lots of beetles, the techniques I use are totally different. But yeah, that's a very good question.
So a lot of your work is examining ecosystems here in the kind of Oklahoma City-ish area, or Oklahoma in general. Is it?
So I have two study regions. I've been doing a lot of work in New Zealand for the last few years, getting back into doing the field work. And I'm trying to expand my work into a region here in Oklahoma and at the Arkansas border called the Uwachita Mountains, which is one of the oldest mountain ranges in North America. And now to look at them, they do not look particularly mountainous. They are old and worn down, so they look kind of like low ridges almost. But this region has a really interesting environmental gradient. It's kind of the very western edge of the eastern wet oak forest complex. So it's getting into this oak pine mixed forest, and with all these hills, there's the warm sunny side of the hill and the cool moist side of the hill. And previous work done by Don Shepherd and other of his colleagues looking at salamanders has found that there are different genetically isolated populations on each of these hills, with a little bit of mixing through the valleys, but not that much. And in my just kind of looking at this area as a potential study system, almost no genetic work has been done on insects at all in this region. The initial, a lot of the survey work was done in the 90s. So it's kind of this potentially really interesting area that hasn't seen an extensive amount of research. It's within driving distance of several major universities. I mean, it's right there. It's not very far from the Ozarks and the Appalachians, which we know are very rich in species diversity for salamanders, for insects, for mussels, for a variety of different taxa. And so it's like, why has this area been kind of neglected? And so I'm looking at it just because it's cool and it's right here and I can take students to it. You know, we can drive over there and camp. And so we've started sampling some beetles. Hope to be looking at genetic diversity in this region over the next couple of years. So previously I've worked in New Zealand, and New Zealand is really interesting from a biogeographical and evolutionary standpoint because it's been isolated for 80 million years. And so evolutionarily, everything looks different on New Zealand than elsewhere.
How long was that again? 80 million?
80 million years.
Okay. And are islands something that... that are, would you say, easier to study in your work?
Or? So islands are interesting because they're smaller. And so it's a lot easier to kind of get at how many species there are and where they came from. And some islands, like if you have an island chain, like an archipelago, you can look at how different arrival times to the different islands and how this has caused different evolutionary opportunities to be filled in different ways. And they're nice and discrete. It's like, this is the community on this island, and this is the community on this island. New Zealand is a little bit different from a lot of islands in that it's actually continental in origin. So it used to be attached to Australia and Antarctica back when all of the southern land masses were connected together in this supercontinent called Gondwana. And so it basically drifted apart, carrying like a raft, several species on it already. So this is very different from, say, Hawaii, where the island popped up out of the sea and was then colonized. So New Zealand, it's been isolated for 80 million years. It left Gondwana before mammals reached that part of Gondwana. So a lot of those ecological niches that are filled by mammals here, like if you think about squirrels and little creatures on the forest floor, this would have been all filled by birds and, for the most part, birds there. Mm. And the flowers are a lot more simple, so there aren't these really strict plant-pollinator relationships that you see in a lot of continental regions. And so for insects, a lot of the diversity is in beetles, and a lot of the beetle diversity is in the leaf litter. So I look at the small brown things that live in the forest floor that you have to particularly be excited about to go and look at it. But the other thing that's exciting about New Zealand is that it's small. And so it has mountain ranges and different climate types and different ecosystem types all in a relatively constrained space. So from the perspective of a biologist, you can actually go and sample in these different places and kind of get a good picture of what's going on in the space of a few years as opposed to a few decades.
Hmm.
But so, yeah, so both of these systems have slightly different questions, but different opportunities, and I think we'll have some interesting outcomes.
It's... In these areas where there was some sort of drift or these tectonic plate shifts or whatever may have happened, is it kind of easy to see? So if you had you had beetles that were on kind of either side of this border, and then there's this split, and then these two the similar origin or the same origin get split up, and now they have a new trajectory in history. Is that something you're looking at, comparing kind of the beetles in New Zealand to the ones in Australia or something to understand the diversity?
So I'm not specifically looking at that, although a lot of people are, and certainly the ancestral group of the Beatles that I work with, you can find the closest relatives of the Beatles I work with in Australia and New Caledonia, which would have been, you know, close proximity. Most of the species that are exist today are much younger, of course, than this drifting off of the continent 80 million years ago. So most of the beetles that I'm working with would have arisen within the last 3 to 10 million years, and so their history from their history, you can see much more recent dynamics, like the mountain chain in the central part of New Zealand is very young. And so there has been a lot of divergence of populations around this mountain chain. Individuals do cross, but not very often. The entire flora associated with these high altitude areas is only about 5 million years old. And so any species that actually live up above tree line are relatively young species. And so that's the temporal dynamics that I'm mostly focused on, is the last 2 million years to the present. So again, it's mostly ice age dynamics and different climate change dynamics and relatively recent landscape evolution in these places.
What are some of the driving factors of change here in Oklahoma? I think it's easy to understand speciation when a landmass drifts apart.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned a mountain range where one side is has a different climate than the other side of the mountain. So, and these are kind of all considered islands in their own way, right?
Definitely.
And is there tornadoes or anything like that in Oklahoma that like create like these mini like kind of changes in the ecosystems?
So I don't know that it has a huge impact on the ecosystems, but yes, Oklahoma is famous for its tornadoes and its wind in general, as you probably would have experienced while driving here. Oklahoma is actually fascinating from an ecological standpoint because there's a pretty stark climatic gradient going across the state. So on the east, there are the last of these oak forests, and it gets quite a lot of rain. And once you get to the very western part of the panhandle, you're getting into environments that look a lot more like what you would expect to find in places like New Mexico. And so in the middle of that is this transition through these different prairie ecotypes. And so we go from a fairly significant amount of rainfall, similar to what you would find in the Smoky Mountains, all the way to not quite desert, but practically desert, and everything in between. And then there are all these different soil types that underlie all of that. And so Oklahoma is just interesting for an ecologist because there's so many things going on. And when you are driving an hour and a half in either direction from Norman, you see a very different thing than if you had gone the other direction. And so I'm relatively new to this area myself, so I'm trying to kind of get a feel for what these different ecosystems are. But it's a really interesting area because there's so much difference, there's so much change over a small space, and some of these ecosystem types are relatively young, like again, dating only back to the last glaciation and more recently. So it's a pretty dynamic environment, and I think people don't necessarily think of the flatter states, which don't have striking features like mountains, as being as interesting, but actually there is really a lot going on here from a biodiversity and ecological perspective.
Does studying a younger species make the job a lot more complicated? Does a younger species have more change going on within its DNA than say a more established species, something that's been around for a while, or is it a case by case?
I think it's a case by case.
I see.
So occasionally people will happen upon situations where it's really hard to categorize based on the genetic diversity that this is species A and this is species B. And so some people have found situations where there may actually be speciation taking place. Mm-hmm. And that gives them a variety of questions to ask, like, do they seem to be diversifying in different environments? Is it just that there's a geographic barrier? Like, what is causing this potential separation? And why is gene flow continuing amongst species that appear to be becoming different species? And so that's one of the things about phylogeography, is that it has allowed people to learn a lot more about the speciation process, and that it's actually a lot messier than we always thought, that species don't just separate neatly into two species. Some of them continue to share genes for a long time, even though the animals themselves look quite different. And so it's been, I think it's the phylogeography was sort of named as a discipline in the late 80s. And since then, it has contributed a lot to the way that we think about evolutionary questions and what makes a species and when do we cut it off and say, okay, this is no longer species A, now we're looking at a different species.
It seems like with biodiversity and phylogeography, it seems like these are pretty ambitious fields to get into. In terms of it seems like they're very interdisciplinary. There's a number of different factors that you're having to. What are the kind of different disciplines that you're having to consider?
So an obvious one would be climatology, because we use climate models to try to predict what happened in the past. Even within the discipline of biogeography, there are a number of different flavors of ecologists. Some people work on mathematical models of diversity patterns. Some people work on evolutionary trees. But also thinking about geologists to better understand the landscapes you're working in, computer scientists, as we deal with different types of sequencing data, but also just dealing with all of the biodiversity data that have been generated over the last 20 to 30 years of interested study. So most scientific research is publicly funded by different government agencies in different countries. And one of the stipulations for that funding is that the data belong to the public, so they're published, right? So we now have 30 years of biodiversity science data that can be mined, and people can look at different patterns. And so the computational aspect, that's another group of people that we're collaborating with now that maybe 10 years ago were not, you know, we were not necessarily looking at them as natural collaborators. So, yeah, I would say that biogeography and phylogeography see collaborations across the scientific disciplines, basically, because we are now pulling in different types of information from all over the place. And that's really what makes it fun and interesting, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know I'm not interested in sitting at my desk working by myself. The thing that makes science cool for me is getting to talk to all these different people about their topics and thinking, man, if we put that together with what I'm thinking about, that's a totally different way to answer this question.
So let's talk about beetles. First off, why the interest in beetles in the first place? Why examining that specific part of this field?
Beetles are the little things that run the world. There are more species of beetle than anything else that we know of. And there are so many beetles that are left to be described, and they are in every terrestrial environment, and they're doing interesting things everywhere. And it's just there's just so much room for discovery that if you want to find something new, that's a good place to start. So The U.S. and Canada, north of Mexico, have around 25,000 species of beetles that are described. New Zealand has 10,000 species of beetles. If you move to the tropics, there are going to be significantly more than that, but still, they don't even know how many beetles there are. And so it's just this really... They're everywhere. Like, everywhere you look, you'll find them. And yet there's so much that we don't know about them. Mm. Like, if you consider species like birds, particularly, which are easy to observe, they're also beautiful in color and do interesting things, and they're everywhere. But we know so much more about them. We know where all the species occur. We know how they reproduce, a little bit about their ecological niches. We know their evolutionary histories and how they're related to each other. For insects and other invertebrates, we are still trying to put names on things and quantify what we don't know. And we will be doing that for a long time to come. And so it's just, and also they're adorable. I mean, if you actually take a close look at them, they have all
really?
These...
Really?
Yes.
I've never heard anyone describe beetles as adorable.
No, they have... I mean, their feet are amazing. They've got these little pads on the bottom of their feet with little bristles on them so uh-huh. they can walk. And I mean, when you actually get one under a microscope and start looking at its little structures, I mean, they are just so interesting and intricate. And then you look at the next one, and it's interesting and intricate in a totally different way. And they're just kind of mind-blowing. So, if you have a chance to just look at some under a microscope or look at really nice macro photography examples of beetles, I mean, they're just gorgeous. Hmm. And unlike other organisms, you can actually pick a beetle up or pick an insect up and look at it and hold it in your hand and kind of admire it and then put it down. And you can imagine that you would get in a lot of trouble if you tried to do that with birds and other things, which might try to bite you. And so as something that you can be enthusiastic about, you can actually put your hands on them and get up close and take a look at them, and it doesn't hurt them and you don't get in trouble. And it's just fun. They're accessible.
Hmm. So when you say there's so much we don't know about beetles, what don't we know? What are you searching for? What kind of questions are you asking?
So for a lot of species, we're just still trying to decide how many species they are, and given this particular beetle, what is it? Is it a different species from something else? And so you would imagine that means that we don't know the evolutionary relationships among groups as well for many groups of beetles, particularly the little brown ones, which is what I especially like. And it makes it harder to ask the types of questions that you need a lot of information for. So what are the major diversity drivers amongst recent diversification in beetles? How have beetles responded to things like climate change? How vulnerable are they to environmental change? And so this is one of those things that people are starting to realize that insects are maybe not doing that well right now. There have been several several studies within the last five-ish years that show significant reductions in population size of insects. So there have been two out of Germany recently where they show they've been trapping flying insects, so like butterflies and moths and flies, over in the same landscapes over 25 years, and they're finding that now their traps have a huge amount less of total weight of insects than they did 25 years ago.
Bees are starting to get a little attention.
Bees are not doing well. Mm-hmm. And it has to do, the native bees are really struggling with land use change. The honeybees are not doing so well with herbicides, it looks like, or neonicotinoid sprays. That's actually a pesticide. But there's also a report out by the EU that a fifth of saprophytic beetle species, this is the beetles that live in dead wood and eat fungi, so a component of native forests, a fifth of those beetles in Europe are not doing so well. aquatic organisms, aquatic insect species like dragonflies and not so much dragonflies, but mayflies and caddisflies are indicators of good water quality, and they're struggling in a lot of places. And so we're not seeing extinction in terms of the disappearance of species, but we're seeing that a lot of once common species are not at the numbers that they used to be. And that's fairly alarming because insects basically run the world. They're involved in nutrient cycling. They're involved in plant pollination. They feed the birds and the other species that we really enjoy to look at. And so this is definitely a cause for concern.
Insects are kind of the canaries of,
yes,
of the world.
Yeah. And so what I'm interested in is understanding how environmental change has affected some of these species in the past. Mm-hmm. So I can look at these ecological questions that I was describing to you earlier, but it also provides an important bit of baseline information, like how easy is it to collect these species? How much genetic diversity does a population have? And we can then go back 10 or 20 years from now, if necessary, and look, have we seen change? Has there been a significant amount of change over this period? If so, what do we think caused this change? Is there anything that we can do to try to fix this problem? And so we've seen a lot of long-term studies of insects and other species that show how species have changed in numbers and abundance or moved their geographic distributions through time. And these are invaluable studies that give us these different windows into time. And I would like for my research to be set up in such a way that while focusing on these ecological and evolutionary questions, I can also provide that baseline data that we can go back to and replicate down the road if we need it.
So what are some of the things causing these alarms? When you talk about water quality, is this human factors happening, or is this...
A lot of it is human factors. So with insects in particular, it has to do with changes in agricultural landscapes in some cases, land use intensification in different parts of the world, the sprays that we put on our crops and how much of it runs off into the surrounding environments. And like, I have to be absolutely clear. I am not anti-agriculture, right? I am from Iowa. You know, I have family that farm. This is a really important thing, but there are different ways that we could potentially try to do some of these things in a way that's slightly more in tune with the environment. We could leave habitat strips. We could potentially reduce the amount of sprays we use.
What are habitat strips?
Just make sure that there are little bits of native habitat left in these agricultural landscapes, right? So thinking about, when I was a kid, Iowa is mostly cornfields, but when you go into these...
My parents are from Iowa.
Okay.
I know Iowa.
Yeah. So when you go into these rivers, there around the rivers are these beautiful little forest patches, and that's often where you find natures in these little tucked away places that are harder to do agriculture in, or have been set aside because they're aesthetically pleasing, and you just see so much life, even in just these little roadside turnouts by rivers. And so just making sure that we continue to have these little habitat reservoirs in different areas is an important start. But also monitoring. You know, I think insects are one of those things that are so ubiquitous that we just don't worry about them. They're like the furniture. But actually keeping an eye on some of these things that are common, supposedly common, finger quotes common, and just make sure they stay common, or check for changes in their numbers through time, just so we actually have an idea of what's going on in the environment around us.
Here's something that I thought was interesting when you were talking. You said the little brown beetles. Mm-hmm. They're your favorite. You say you have a favorite beetle. Do you have beetles that you like dislike? Like, oh, I hate this species. That beetle's a real jerk. What is it about a particular beetle that you have a fondness for?
So all beetles have really cute feet. Okay. I think it's just that they're secret. Mm-hmm. And so I collect the beetles that I work with by rolling over dead logs and looking at the bit of fungus on the underneath of that. And I think they're there. Like, anybody could find them, but nobody's looking for them. And so I think it's kind of this thing that I like because I'm finding out the secret. So I'm not crazy about the beetles that end up in your house in large numbers, like the ladybugs, and around here, for some reason, we get goldenrod beetles in the spring, and I noticed they're starting to appear in the corners of the houses. So I'm not crazy about things like that, but I wouldn't say there are any beetles that I hate. I mean, I would not go and pick up the ones that feed on carrion or dung with the enthusiasm that I pick up the ones that live on dead wood and leaves, but, sure. You know, I don't mind them.
Sure. So you think the ladybug gets too much play? And they're the famous ones.
They are famous, but I mean, it's
overrated, huh?
When it's week two of vacuuming them off your ceiling, I can understand being a little irritated by them.
So what's influencing a beetle's life and some of their evolutionary trajectory and some of their the drivers of their diversity? Have temperature, plant life, weather, seasons. How many in the area here in Oklahoma that you're studying? How many different species are there, and what are the kind of the influences in this particular region that you're looking at?
So I don't actually know how many species are in this region, and I think it's because I'm new to this region. But they, like anything else, they need places to eat and places to live. And so different beetles and insects in general have different temperature tolerances. And so at the broader scale, that'll the temperatures they can tolerate, particularly overwintering temperatures, and where they do that, like do they have a place that they can hide out or burrow into, determines where they live. A lot of insects are associated with flowers, and so if we're looking at deep in evolutionary time, the diversification of insects is probably related to the diversification of flowering plants. And so anywhere that you have a higher diversity of plant species, you're probably going to have more different kinds of insects as well. And some of the beetle species that I work with live on fungus in the woods. And so what they need is a nice bed of leaf litter, and they need places where moisture stays long enough that the fungus can grow and they can live out their life cycle on it. So a whole bunch of different factors, going from the local scale of what's happening in your local forest all the way up to the continental scale, determine the diversity of species and where they're found. But in general, the more different types of environments there are, the more different types of species there are. And for insects, the more interesting plants and little tiny pockets of habitat in an environment, the more insects you're going to have. So you could have, you know, a sandy bank with really colorful tiger beetles running around on it next to a river. And in that river, there might be different beetles that live in the riffles that eat the different microorganisms and algae and things in the river, or actively hunt other species. And then if you imagine going up that sandy bank and eventually you get into the forest, there's going to be a whole bunch of different types of beetles in the forest that are up in the tree canopy and in the bushes and in the flowering plants and the bark and down on the dead trees and dead organisms in the forest floor. So Oklahoma is one of the places where the American burying beetle lives, which is an endangered species, and that eats small carrion. So they do the insects and in particular the beetles are doing just about everything it's possible to do in an environment. And so that's why there are so many of them and they're so broadly distributed and why I think they're so worthy of study.
What is the role that they're playing in ecosystems? We talked when we were talking about dung beetles, we kind of talked about what happens when you don't have something happens, you don't have dung beetles around and you have these cow patties piling up everywhere, right. And that becomes an issue. What's the importance of the beetles that you're looking at?
So they're probably involved in nutrient cycling just because they're part of the decompositional process for dead wood in forests. And again, this is one of those things where not that much, like I don't think there have been a lot of experiments, although there is a group in Germany that's doing some cool experiments on manipulating beetle communities and forest types, but based on where they're found, they're probably pretty important in nutrient cycling in forest ecosystems. And they may be important in helping with fungal dispersal. And I mean, this is totally hand wavy, right? This is like just kind of the sorts of stuff that I think about when I'm out in the forest. And probably somebody is actually working on these questions, but I don't know the answer. But yeah, they're probably important in a lot of these small things that we don't necessarily see, but what's considered part of the brown food web, which is how stuff decomposes so that we have nutrient cycling. Mm. So cleaning up the ecosystem in different ways. Those are the beetles that I work on. Other ones will be important in pollination and, you know, things more associated with flowers. So it depends on where they live.
Okay, so I might, as we wrap up here, I might be putting you on the spot a little bit here. If people want to learn a little more about, say, biogeography, phylogeography, is there a pop science book out there that you recommend for people? See, I was worried. You don't hear a lot about the new hot pop science biogeography out there.
So,
anything that inspired you?
So I'm a little bit weird in that I don't read a lot of pop science.
No, you're an actual scientist, so that's common.
But thinking about books that specifically deal with biogeography, probably some of the books by David Quammen. Mm. And I think...
How do you spell that?
Quammen. Mm-hmm. And I'm totally crashing on the title.
That's okay.
But yeah, he writes a lot of books that are kind of about biogeographic patterns broadly scaled, and they tend to be really well enjoyed. People really like them. But also, I think I would be remiss if I didn't mention E.O. Wilson, who is an ecologist. He's in his 80s. He's still publishing on biodiversity issues, and he's kind of shifted from... Well, he co-wrote some of the really important theories in ecology, island biodiversity theory.
He's one of the legends.
He is one of the legends, but he's also very active in conservation work and communicating to people about the importance of biodiversity conservation. And so his books also tend to be very well written and very accessible and enjoyed by a lot of people outside the sciences, as well as folks like me who are actually working in the sciences. And so either of those two authors would be great places to look.
Awesome. And I have each week I have my guests plug a nonprofit of their choice. And which one did you pick?
I picked the National Park Foundation, which is the official charity of the National Park Service. And so I was thinking about, there are a lot of really great conservation organizations doing really excellent conservation work, but I was thinking about the national parks in particular, because I'm guessing a lot of the people who listen to your podcast didn't get into science in the first place by listening to a lot of facts. And so the people that I know who are excited about nature can trace that back to experiences that they've had in nature. And the national parks in the United States are just phenomenal. I mean, they this is a very, very special thing that we have, that people come from around the world to look at. And so the National Parks Foundation helps the National Park Service put together programs in the parks to get people out there learning about things, enjoying nature, and providing opportunities for people to have the types of experiences that will make them interested in nature and interested in conserving nature.
That sounds fantastic. Who doesn't like parks?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you, Catherine, so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you, listeners, for being such wonderful, curious people. We'll talk with you next week. Next week on the podcast, what a fantastic guest. Especially, this is always fun when I can have someone on that's into, because we're going to be talking about guns a bit next week. I'm not a big gun guy myself. I know people with their arguments, constitutional rights, and they got to be prepared for government tyranny and blah, blah, blah. I just think they're a little silly. I grew up around a lot of hunters and I've used guns, I've hunted, you know, whatever. I think they're a hair silly, and that's kind of the nicest thing that I have to say about guns. But my guest next week, big into guns, loves them, loves guns, loves security, loves law enforcement, and he's studies how to improve law enforcement training, how to make better decisions in stressful situations, does test people on gun safety. He was a gun safety instructor for a while, and just a really interesting dude and really fascinating. And I learned so much, and we had some good laughs too. So I think you're really going to enjoy next week's. It's always nice when I have someone into something that I'm not necessarily into. I feel like it's a good opportunity for me to learn, and I think you guys will as well. So hope you enjoy the podcast as much as I like making them. Thanks for all the reviews and ratings on iTunes and everything. Thanks for spreading the word to your friends and not your enemies. Sometimes people say enemies too, but you know, maybe keep it away from your enemies. Maybe just form like a coalition of allies to all listen to the Here We Are podcast together and learn together and improve, learn valuable skills that will improve your lives, and then you're going to be able to hopefully outsmart your enemies, maybe at least be a little more interesting in conversations, maybe not be as boring as your enemies. Yeah, so keep it from them. Don't tell them about the show. But thank you for spreading the word to your friends and family. Thanks for the iTunes reviews. I very much appreciate it. Music this week by Sam Goodwill. Special thanks to Jimmy Fro with the Jimmy Fro Podcast for doing such a wonderful sound mixing job and editing job on this podcast, and for introducing me to all sorts of cool indie music on his podcast, the Jimmy Fro Podcast. Those of you that listen all the way to the end, you are, of course, my favorite.
let's say Seinfeld was on an island and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
It might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you